Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the show, Sports Takeover on RMU Radio with Matt and Chris. Plenty of sports news this week, so let's jump right in. With First and Short, we're going to give you a quick update on the playoffs starting in the NBA. What does the playoff picture look like, Chris?
Well, in the NBA, the Western Conference is much more set than the Eastern Conference. All eight teams are currently in the positions that will represent the Western Conference. There is nobody else that can get in. They are all locked into place. Now, where they go inside that eight seeds, there's still much room for debate there, but those eight teams are locked in. In the Eastern Conference, it's really still up for grabs. The bottom three spots are still separated between five different teams, and now those teams are only separated by four games. The 10th seed, Charlotte, not really in it as much, but the other four teams are really right there.
Yeah, only three games back for Charlotte at the 10th spot, but Orlando at number nine is half a game back, and 6, 7, and 8 are all hovering right around 500, maybe a game over, maybe a game under. So lots to still be decided in the East, but the West is pretty much good to go. All eight teams that will be in are in. They have clinched. Just a matter of who's going to play who. In the NHL, sort of a similar situation. The West is slightly more determined than the East is. Winnipeg, Nashville, St. Louis, your top three in one division. Calgary, San Jose, and Vegas in the other. Dallas has clinched one wild card spot while the other is still up for grabs. Colorado holds it at the moment. Arizona could still get it. They're the only one that could still get it, but they have some work to do to make that happen. In the East, Washington and the Islanders have clinched in the Metro Division, with Pittsburgh sitting at number three, not having clinched yet. In the Atlantic, it's Tampa, Boston, Toronto clinched. Wild cards currently are Carolina and Columbus. Neither one of them are in for sure. And Montreal is right behind them, tied with Columbus. Anything can happen in those three spots.
Yeah, in the Western Conference, the Central really is up for grabs between Winnipeg, Nashville, and St. Louis. If St. Louis wins tonight, all three teams will be tied at 96 points with two games remaining for each team. Exciting there. Seems that Colorado really has that second spot wrapped up. They have a four-point advantage on Arizona. They need to lose out. Arizona needs a win out. Lots of stuff that can happen. Eastern Conference, like you said, Washington Islanders already clinched. Pittsburgh and Carolina, they're right there. If Pittsburgh gets 2 points, they will clinch. They just need to win one of their last two games. But really, wild card, Carolina, Columbus, Montreal, 1 point separate those three teams. It's anybody's game as far as I'm concerned. Should be exciting hockey down the line. Moving ahead, the AAF and the CWHL. Some leagues that may not have had the notoriety that the NFL or the MLB have had, they've made some headlines this week, Matt. Let's start in the AAF. What was the big headline?
So some unfortunate news coming out of both of these leagues. For the AAF, they are suspending operations immediately. They have not folded yet. They are headed in that direction, but for the time being, their 10-week season is going to conclude, I guess, here at 8. Unfortunate to hear that for them, and it's not financial trouble, or at least it doesn't appear to be. We kind of touched on this last week. It's a lack of some support from the NFL Players Association, which to me is interesting because I feel like as a developmental league, their argument is that as a developmental league, they should be able to use young, inexperienced players in the NFL because that is what their purpose is, and I understand that. But to me, that's something that you should have figured out before you put together rosters and had games being played. So I'm not sure why that wasn't determined before things kind of started here, why we've even come to this point.
Yeah, it kind of almost seems like they were just kind of banking on it, the fact that, yeah, you know, they're going to be in a good agreement between the NFL. I mean, I guess initially they thought, okay, they're going to show games on NFL Network. The NFL is going to be full head with us. But I guess there was, and like most places of business, some sort of miscommunication between the NFL and the AAF between how much their players and such were going to be able to work between both leagues. And we thought that when Tom Dundon, owner of the Carolina Hurricanes, came in, that he kind of saved the league. He made a $250 million investment several weeks back after the first week because they were struggling to make bank, make payroll in various instances. Well, it still seems like that was kind of a problem. Apparently, players had to pay for their own flights home following the suspension of the league. So, you know, wherever your team happened to be at that time, you just had to get lucky and go home. And I also saw that Orlando is having trouble with their practice team. They had to practice 3 hours away in a place in Georgia for some reason. I don't know what the whole situation was there, but clearly things were not all solid there. But it really was interesting that Bill Pullian, he was one of the original founders of the league, it really didn't seem like he agreed with Dundon on the whole suspension of the league. What was your thoughts on that?
Yeah, him and Charlie Ebersole, the other co-founder, I don't think either one of them wanted this to happen. And it's kind of disappointing if you're in their position. You put all this work in and start this thing. Tom Dundon comes in, becomes your new chairman, and he's the one that ultimately makes the decision. they don't really have a say in it. And you talk about the miscommunication. It's a very costly miscommunication.
Absolutely.
Because it will cost the league upwards of $20 million and Dundon himself upwards of $70 million. That's an incredible amount of money to lose, to me, on something that could have been established a while ago. And I mean, what this league was able to accomplish in less than a year was incredible. The turnaround between the time that the idea was conceived and the time that the product was put on the field, I think, is remarkable. But I think now you're seeing that maybe they should have slowed down, taken some more time, and worked something out with the NFL before they dove in the way that they did. Not to take anything away from what they've accomplished since the Super Bowl, but it's disappointing to see at least... if they only make it one season, that's disappointing enough. But to not even see a conclusion here to the first season is disappointing. And I've said on the show how excited I was about this league. So it's unfortunate to see what the turn that things have taken for them.
And you weren't the only one that's excited for the league. I mean, viewership on CBS Sports Network and all their different channels has hovered between 400,000 and 500,000 for essentially every week of the league. We saw big name Johnny Manziel recently join the league. I mean, there's been other NFL players that have been in the league. There are names that are recognizable. It's football in the spring. People enjoy it. It's just the fact that I don't think that the founders necessarily have the right idea in terms of how much finances are necessary for this kind of thing. Eight teams is really a lot of teams for a small startup league like this. Six or four would be much more manageable. Eight obviously gets you more exposure, but at the same time, you have to be able to fund all these teams, which clearly they were not able to do. And then there was various other aspects that just seemed like it was kind of a hobby and not really solidified. Like the championship game was scheduled to be at UNLV Stadium, Sam Boyd Stadium, that is out in Nevada. But apparently there was never any formal agreement between Sam Boyd Stadium and the AAF. So recently it was announced that the championship game was moved to Frisco, Texas. Well, there were still tickets that were on sale for that game at UNLV. It's just there was such a disconnect between them. I don't know what went wrong there. And it's interesting because it's suspended. It's not entirely folded. Suspension can, you know, can be indefinite, obviously.
They can come back from this.
Right, but...
can.
Whether they do or not, I don't know about. But the referees in an email they received said that, yes, this week is off, but maybe weeks 9 and 10 are on still, which they're clearly not on. There's no way they're going to play again this season. It's just there seems to be a general inconsistency across the beliefs of many of the people in charge in this league.
Yeah, it certainly seems as though there was an expectation of how things would kind of unfold, and it seems as though, like you talked about with the lack of agreement between them and the stadium for their championship game, the lack of agreement between them and the NFL and the NFL's Player Association, it just seems like there was a lot that they expected to fall into place that just didn't. But what I will say is that they have accomplished their goal, at least in the short term. There are guys who played in the league this year that should get a shot in the NFL that I think did prove themselves in a very short amount of time. And I think that the way that they've revolutionized certain aspects of the game, I think the NFL will take note and will make adjustments based on what they've seen. So I think it is disappointing. It is not what we expected and certainly not what they expected, but I do think that there are positives to take out of it. And like you said, suspended, not folded. Will they come back? Perhaps.
And the one thing is that Vince McMahon's restarted XFL begins next spring. He can look at what happened in the AAF, maybe make his own changes, saying, okay, why this business not work out? What can we do to help ours maybe? Obviously, Vince McMahon had a lot more issues with the XFL from a surface level, but hey, at least their season actually concluded back whenever it was around. So we'll see what that is moving forward. But for right now, AAF operations are suspended. Another league's operation suspended, the CWHL, that is the Canadian Women's Hockey League. They are ceasing operations as of May 1st, 2019. They had six teams. They were four in Canada, one in Massachusetts, and for whatever reason, one in China. And they have been around since 2007. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, the fact that they had a team in China was very surprising to me. I thought that was very odd. It sounds like they pretty much paid for themselves, so I don't know what the mindset was there, but... interesting, just very interesting. The league as a whole, again, it's disappointing because it was a league that was having some success. I believe I saw that their most recent championship game or championship series was record-setting for them in terms of viewership. So they were doing well. They just recently started paying their players. 2017, they did that for the first time. more of a stipend than it is actual like a paycheck. It's very minimal, $2,000 to $10,000 a season, so not a lot there. But it seems that the issue was not the popularity or the play on the ice. It was the business model was just unsustainable. Disappointing to see that. And this is even after they've been getting help from the NHL. That will be redirected to the NWHL here in North America or in the United States. So that's kind of exciting to see. Maybe that league takes off, but it's disappointing to see that come at the expense of this league.
Yeah, so the league had its Clarkson Cup, which is its equivalent of the Stanley Cup. Its final last week was broadcast on NHL Network, had 175,000 viewers, which, for all things considered, not too bad. It's a network not everybody gets. Not everybody obviously is interested in hockey, let alone women's Canadian hockey. But to get that amount of viewership, not too bad. But yeah, you mentioned it. The business model just is not good. And that maximum $10,000 is in Canadian dollars, which translates to around $8,000 US. So from our standpoint, it's even less. And for the fact that they only began paying players in 2017, you can show that they clearly did not have much money in what they did. They went through rather quickly. Now, the NWHL and the CWHL, they had never worked together, which I always thought was odd, seeing how the NHL is in both Canada and the United States, obviously. So the NHL used to give equal money to both leagues because they did not want to pick favorites, which is a smart move by Gary Bettman. Now, with the CWHL ceasing operations, all of that money can be redirected in the WNHL, which I think is very good because that can help the sport grow more here in the United States. And we've even seen that the WHL is now going to add expansion teams in Toronto and Montreal, two of the cities where there were CWHL teams. Whether they're the same team or not, I don't know if that's quite ironed out yet. But the fact is, there are going to be two more franchises added to their team, which I believe will bring them up to seven for the total. So at least they're moving forward in the right direction. But the NHL does not want to have a full partnership with it. They just want to be a big sponsor because, once again, they don't necessarily believe in the same business model, but the NHL has expressed that in case something happens where there's no women hockey, they will step in and make their own league. So that's good from that standpoint, I think.
Yeah, and like you said, them not working together is kind of surprising because you would think that, you know, you're playing for the same purpose. You're trying to get women's hockey put on the map, and you would think that putting your efforts together would make that more successful. Well, they're not exactly together now, but there is one focal point, one league that the NHL will give assistance to, and hopefully it takes off and does not come to the same point that this league has. But unfortunately, for the time being, this league has closed its doors.
So ideally, these will be the last two league closures we have to discuss for a while. Kind of unfortunate that they happened the same week, but convenient for discussion's sake. Moving ahead now, Major League Baseball season just kicked off in totality last week, but just as we did in the NHL at the beginning of the season, lots of injuries so far. But even more importantly, though, we've been talking about extensions for the past few weeks. One extension this week, it's a big one. It is Ronald Acuña Jr., the reigning Rookie of the Year for the National League of the Atlanta Braves. He just signed an 8-year, $100 million extension. That's good for $12.5 million every year. Is that a steal for the Braves, Matt?
It's hard to say. He's 21 years old, and this is only his second season. And you know me, I like to see more than one season out of somebody before I want to totally jump on board with him. But he was the National League Rookie of the Year last year. He hit .293, 26 home runs, 64 RBIs. Very good stat line. If he continues to keep up this type of pace throughout the 8 years, then yes, it is absolutely a steal. Will he hit a sophomore slump? Will he not turn out to be the player that he was last year? That's still a possibility as well. But given some of the contracts that we've discussed and some of the annual values that we've talked about, that is not one that is going to break the bank. Overall, I think it's a good move.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he had a good season last year. Will he hit a sophomore slump? I think so. We've seen last year Cody Bellinger and Aaron Judge, while still having good seasons, did not have the monstrous seasons that they had the year before. It seems like most players kind of hit a sophomore recession, which, I mean, if he still gets 20 home runs, as far as I'm concerned, that's still good. He has some other players in the Braves now. Josh Donaldson can help him a little bit. Nick Markakis is still there. His fellow, now sophomore, Ozzie Albies is still there. So it's all right. He has the players and pieces around him. But 8 years, $100 million, it's a big investment on a guy we've only seen one season from. But he had been touted as one of the best prospects, the best, I believe, last year, and he clearly delivered. So if he can continue to deliver, it's definitely a steal for the Braves, because when he'll be done with his contract, he'll be 29, where he can probably be expecting $30 million a season. So to keep him under for 12, it's good now. Just have to see how it plays out.
Yeah, if it works out well, that'll certainly be something that they can brag about for years to come. But something that no one's bragging about is the injuries that are piling up for these teams. less than a week into the season. It's incredible how many injuries we have right now, especially if you're the New York Yankees, because the list for the Yankees is incredibly long. Giancarlo Stanton, Miguel Andujar, Luke Voit, Luis Severino, Jacoby Ellsbury, Dylan Betances, Aaron Hicks, Ben Heller, Didi Gregorius, and Jordan Montgomery.
That's 10 people, Matt.
Holy cow. That's half the lineup almost.
Yeah.
That's half the roster. That's incredible.
And these are real people, too. They're injured, like Andujar, Didi, Aaron Hicks, Stanton. They're all everyday starters. Luis Severino, he is their staff ace, essentially. I mean, these are people that they need to be on their team to fulfill our predictions for them to make it to the World Series.
Yeah, no kidding.
And for them all getting hurt now, it's bad, especially Andujar. He might even have season-ending surgery. I think he has a torn labrum, I believe. He hasn't gotten the surgery yet, but it's not good. Didi's out till June. Everyone else should be back by the end of May, but still, definitely not the foot you want to be starting the season on if you're the New York Yankees.
Yeah, just looking at this list here, Luke Voit was probable for today's game. Other than that, though, I think the closest date that they're expecting... Okay, Betances is supposed to be back in about a week. Stanton at the end of the month. But yeah, we're into May. There's some into June. Gregorius is expected roughly June 15th. So these guys are short-term to long-term. But again, it's half the roster for the Yankees. It's incredible. And there's plenty of other notable names as well. Scooter Gennett is one for Cincinnati who does not necessarily have a lot going for them. Scooter Gennett is one that you would like to have healthy. Francisco Lindor in Cleveland is one. Daniel Murphy in Colorado. Many more. Chris, what other ones are out there?
All right, there's Corey Knebel from the Brewers. He's getting Tommy John. He's done for the whole season. Justin Upton has turf toe on a bad Angels team. He's out 8 to 12 weeks. Matt Olson slugged it well last year for the A's. Well, he's going to be slugging it with a hand injury for the next 5 to 7. Steven Souza Jr., new acquisition for the Diamondbacks. Sounds like it was a good idea, right? He's going to be rounding third base, going home, easy run. As he steps over home plate, he tears his ACL, his PCL, and his LCL, all just slipping on the plate. It is remarkable that he blew up his entire knee literally just sliding across home plate, standing. It wasn't like a slide. He just ran, and it's miraculous. But, yeah, he's done for the season. Lindor, you mentioned. Kyle Seager, Corey's older brother, but not quite as good. 10 to 12 weeks. He also had hand surgery last night. Trey Turner took a pitch to the finger, and he broke his finger. He's out indefinitely. Boston, reigning AL MVP of the World Series, being Steve Pearce, and former MVP Dustin Pedroia. Well, neither of these guys are playing currently. You mentioned Daniel Murphy, Michael Fulmer, ace of the Tigers, could have been a Cy Young candidate. Well, instead, he is a Tommy John candidate and will be done for the whole season. Same goes for Kansas City's catcher, Salvador Perez. I think I got them all. You got any more you want to add?
I mean, there's other more minor ones. I think Kershaw's out, but I don't think that one's for very long.
Yeah, that's like a week
or two. Rich Hill, also for the Dodgers, so their pitching staff has taken some hits early on. Yoenis Cespedes, not the player that he once was, but for the Mets, he's...
Nor the heels he once had.
That's true as well. Lonnie Chisenhall in Pittsburgh, haven't even seen him play in a regular season game yet.
I'm not mad about that, though, but...
It's just another one to add to the list on top of a Polanco, who we talked about at the end of last season not being healthy for the Pirates. Todd Frazier for the Mets as well, so they've got some
Jed
guys.
Jed Lowry on the Mets as well.
Jed Lowry, so the Mets are doing well despite these injuries, but it's just incredible how quickly these pile up. Some are from last season, some are from over the winter, whatever the case may be, but just an incredible amount of injuries.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because I think with the 10-day DL, or IL rather, is now known as the injury list that they made a few years back, I feel like people are more easily able to add people to the IL, whether or not they actually are fully injured. Like, oh, you know, I got a strained side, I could sit on the bench for 2 days and give it a go, or I can just take 10 days off and be 100% healthy. So I feel like that 10 days gives managers a lot of freedom to say, okay, I can pick and pluck players between my AAA and my starting roster, especially at the beginning of the season when these kind of injuries are more susceptible in the colder weather. Bodies aren't quite as loose into the regular season vibe yet. So interesting to see how the IL has played out, but definitely some news about that coming later in the show. That's a little teaser for it.
Just a couple other updates on Major League Baseball early on. The Phillies were the last team without a loss. They did lose this afternoon. They are sitting at 4-1. So Bryce Harper, in his return to Washington, had a nice game last night, another decent game today, and he's certainly helping the Phillies early on. Some surprise teams, the Red Sox, reigning champions, are sitting at 1-5, while the Seattle Mariners are sitting at 7-1. Certainly way too early to make a big deal out of that. Just interesting that that's where we sit at this point.
You think it's way too early? I think it is the right time to make a big deal of that. Boston is 1-5. They played Seattle, so clearly that's where they got their losses from. They gave up 42 runs over six games. That's 7 a game. They have a negative 18 run differential, worst in Major League Baseball. The Mariners, on the other hand, 7-1. They are the best team in baseball. They have a plus 17 run differential, which I don't know where that came from. They have 56 runs scored, which is also good for 7 runs a game on offense. They are doing significantly better than they should be doing. Some of the teams that are bottom of the barrel in the league, the Angels, not really any surprise there. They don't really have a lot going for them. The Pirates, Cubs, and Reds and Atlanta all also only have 1 win. Still early. The Brewers are looking just as strong as they did last season, which is not good news for anybody else in the National League Central. Cleveland's 2-3. The rest of that division's kind of it's up in the air. But the Baltimore's 4-2. Tampa Bay is 5-2. Those teams are playing excellently. Tampa Bay has given up 11 runs in 7 games. They have just pitched immaculately. It's really remarkable there.
Yeah, the Orioles are already like a tenth of the way to their win total from last year.
Yeah, good what things are happening.
What a start for them.
Baltimore.
Yeah, but you think it's early enough, or you think we can make a big deal out of it? I'm not that concerned about it. I mean, we talked about some injuries some of these teams are dealing with. For the Red Sox, I mean, you've got 162 games to prove that you're a playoff team and a championship contender. I'm not too concerned with the first 6. Obviously, it's not a good start, and some of those numbers that you read off are bad, but I think that they've got plenty of time.
Yeah, I mean, they're a team that has obviously good hitting, but the pitching is what really helped pave the way. You know, Eovaldi, Chris Sale, no longer Craig Kimbrell, but if these guys keep struggling, it's not going to be good for them. Some notable players that have had good starts this season. You mentioned Bryce Harper's return to Philadelphia last night. He was 3-for-5.
Washington,
yeah, thank
you.
With
Philadelphia.
Thank you very much. I just got them both combined into one team there. He went 3-for-5, a triple shy. The cycle had 3 RBIs. Oh, and a 458-foot home run to say, thanks, DC. But no thanks. He's hitting .429, 3 home runs, 5 RBIs already to start the season. Paul Goldschmidt had a 3 home run game over the weekend. He's doing all the good things in St. Louis that I expected from him. He's hitting .400 with 4 home runs and 8 RBIs. Christian Yelich, he won MVP last season. Some people may have thought he's going to fall off this season. He's out here to prove everybody wrong, hitting .409 with 4 home runs, 8 RBIs, and he had a home run in 4 consecutive games to open the season. Really remarkable from him. One more great hitter, Zach Greinke. Wait, isn't Zach Greinke a pitcher? Yes, he is. But last night, he had 2 home runs to go along with his 10 strikeouts against the Padres. He is the first pitcher with 2 home runs in a game since Madison Bumgarner in 2017. And guess who the pitcher was in that game, Matt?
I'm going to say it was Greinke.
Yes, Greinke was the one that gave up the home runs to Bumgarner.
Full circle.
Yeah, apparently. Unfortunately, not against the Giants, but still a remarkable game from him. Bumgarner had a home run last night, and Yulish Chacin had a home run over the weekend. So we've seen 4 home runs from pitchers less than a week into the season.
That's weird, too. Lots of good starts there. One quick thing I do want to ask you about before we go to break. Bryce Harper was not received well in his return to Washington.
No.
We've also seen in the NHL, John Tavares has made a couple returns to Long Island where Islanders fans have not been kind to him either.
That's putting it nicely.
I personally am not a fan of these fans giving these players a hard time. When you have guys on your team that have been the focal point of your team for years, they have every right to leave if they so choose. They are very entitled to going wherever they want to, signing with whoever they'd like. I understand that some fans feel betrayed when that happens, but at the end of the day, it's a business, and we expect so much from these players. I certainly think we can give them a little bit of leeway there. I just wonder what your thoughts are on the way that some of these players have been treated.
Yeah, the Nationals fans acted like Bryce Harper did not give his whole soul to the city of Washington for the last 4 or 5 years, however many it was. He got them division championships. Washington was one of the worst teams in the league before that Harper set on the field for them. They turned into a perennial contender, clearly didn't get where they wanted to, but still, excellent player with them. And for them to boo him in the way they did, I mean, he was your team. Yes, you had other pieces. You know, Steven Strasburg was the ace to go along with Harper in the field, but still, he was Washington, D.C., essentially. When you look at all the other sports teams in D.C., the Redskins, the Wizards, the Capitals, yes, Alex Ovechkin is there, but other than Ovechkin, there's not really been anybody that DC can, you know, rally behind. Harper was that guy. And yeah, you said Tavares and New York. What's their issue? John Tavares was great on their team. He's an excellent center, one of the top 5 in the league, in my opinion, and there's no reason why they have to be mad that he wants to play in his hometown for a team with that, you know, he just wants to go play with. It's very silly to see that teams receive the fans, or the fans receive the players in this way. The only people I expect this from would be when Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell return to Pittsburgh. If they don't get booed out of the stadium, the Steelers fans are doing something wrong. But I have a feeling that they will get booed, rightfully so, though.
Yeah, and it's always, I mean, you expect a little bit of both for these type of players, but to have, I mean, pretty much nothing but boos, burnt jerseys are something that people like to throw into the mix as well. It's just, I don't know. I have a hard time rooting for somebody like that and then just doing a full 180 and going completely against them. I don't like it. Just wanted to see what your thoughts were.
That was a good question. I definitely did like it. Right now, we are going to take a quick break, but coming up, we have March Madness recap. A lot more happened. A lot more is to come, so please stay tuned.
Welcome back to Sports Takeover, Matt and Chris. We're going to take a look now at March Madness as it continues. Sweet 16 was played last weekend. Let's start there. A couple close calls in that round, Duke being one of them, the top seed overall in the tournament, pulls out a 75-73 win over number 4 Virginia Tech. Number 1 Virginia, 53-49 over number 12 Oregon, obviously Oregon being the lowest seed remaining at that point in the tournament. What did you make of those two games?
Well, Duke, we'll talk about it for the Elite Eight, too, but
of course
they've looked bad, really bad, in all of the tournament. Virginia Tech was a team that they handled with relative ease in the regular season, and for the fact that the guy missed a layup in the last second of the game, it was like UCF all over again. The layup was right there, bounced off the rim and out, and no overtime was had. But yeah, Duke, they did not really stand as strong as they did. And Oregon, while it was a close game, I don't necessarily think that they had as good of a chance. Virginia, excellent defensive team, best in college basketball, I believe, defensive efficiency at least, pace of play. They just command the game so well. It's hard to see a team like Oregon that really didn't have a lot going for them. Yes, they've been playing well of late, but for them to give them a big contest, not so great. Some other notable margins of defeat. Two teams won by 17, one team won by 19. Thankfully for me, my bold prediction of a team winning by 20 did not come true from those games. Funny to see, but it's unfortunate. Purdue went to overtime against Tennessee. Tennessee was another team that looked really bad all of March Madness, even before that in the SEC tournament. Purdue ended up winning in overtime, so clearly Tennessee did not have what it took to be the number two seed that they were given. And Kentucky, while they only beat Houston by four, I don't know that the four indicates how close it was. Yes, it was close.
It was very back and forth.
Yeah, it was back and forth, but I think towards the end, Kentucky kind of took control. So some close games there, but definitely some expected outcomes for sure.
Auburn and USNC was probably the biggest upset. I mean, you can only call a five so much of an upset, but it was 17 points over the number one seed in that region. So
yeah, it was a blowout. It wasn't close at all.
No, Auburn's been playing very well, and UNC got to see that up close and personal. You talked about the 19-point game. That was Michigan, a number two seed. I thought this was going to be a really good game. They came out with 44 points against Texas Tech, and I know Texas Tech has a tremendous defense, but 44 points is horrible. For me, that was the biggest letdown of the Sweet 16.
Yeah, I mean, Michigan is a team that is 1 year removed from making the finals against Villanova, and to only put up 44 in the Sweet 16, I mean, it's bad. I mean, they only, you know, Texas Tech scored 63. That's not bad defensively to go up 63 points, but to only score 44, that's less than half of what Auburn got. I mean, obviously you're not going to compete when you only put up 44. Michigan State, they blew the water out of LSU. LSU looked bad all tournament as well. They can get thrown into the same field that Tennessee and even Duke, honestly, can get thrown into. They got blown out by 17 to Michigan State. Wasn't really a contest there. Gonzaga beat Florida State by 14, and it was really no contest there. Gonzaga was in control for the entirety of the game, much to my upsettingness of my bracket.
Into the Elite Eight, we have some other stories, and we'll start with Duke because obviously everyone knows what happens to Duke, and we've talked about how unimpressive they've looked in the two rounds previous, but they go down. The top seed overall falls to number two, Michigan State, 68-67, another very close game. This time, the bounces did not go in their favor.
No, they did not go at all in their favor. Towards the end of the game, they had the opportunity to tie it with two free throws from R.J. Barrett. Well, he missed one of them, so there was the one-point swing. Then Michigan State got the ball back, inbounded it, and instead of being fouled, he just sprinted around the entirety of Duke's team in the last 4 seconds to win the game for them. But yeah, Duke was a team that I believe it was around 40% or so of the brackets.
40%, sounds right, yeah.
They had been picked to win the entirety of it, and they did not even make it to the Final Four. This might be one of the best Duke teams to not have won it. They have three players that will probably be drafted in the first round, even possibly top 10. Zion is most definitely going to be number one overall, but R.J. Barrett has a strong case for being number two or three. So Coach K, in the one-and-done era that we see, he had the best opportunity to get his one-and-done championship with this team, and he just did not get it done. And they really should have lost earlier in the tournament, but for them to lose to Michigan State just – it's kind of just because Michigan State has been playing extremely well recently.
It's kind of funny in sports the way that there's always seems to be a clear favorite, and that clear favorite always seems to find a way to not win. And then the Capitals, we've talked about this, are a perfect example. Two straight President's Trophies, couldn't get out of the second round. They have a poor regular, not a poor regular season, but by their standards, not as good a regular season, and they go and win. And you talk about Duke, one of the better Duke teams that we've seen. Other Duke teams have won a championship, and more will in the future, I'm sure. This one did not, even though they were the favorites. Just kind of interesting how that works out. Number one, Gonzaga, also one of the top seeds to go down. They fall to number three, Texas Tech, 75-69.
Yeah, Texas Tech, they're a team that I don't think anybody expected to do this well. Were they good all season? Absolutely. They did not win the Big 12 tournament, though. They were a three seed. I think rightfully so. They didn't win, but they were good enough all season. Three is appropriate for them, but they've really done very well in all their games. They've won their first by 15, their second by 20. They beat Michigan State by 19. Gonzaga a little bit closer at six, but still they put up 75. But more importantly, they held Gonzaga to 69, a team that had been averaging 88 points per game during the regular season. So when you can play your style of basketball against a team like Gonzaga, who they're 2 years removed from making the championship, so when you can play your own style of basketball, it really helps out your team. But Texas Tech, they're no team to be feared. They have beaten now the last two runners-up. I mean, they're a team that is as real as anybody else, hence why they're in the Final Four, too. It's just not the team I would have expected from that region, but they certainly have earned it, and they deserve to be there.
They have indeed. Virginia, the only number one seed to advance to the Final Four, they knock off number three Purdue 80-75. And Auburn, who we talked about as being red hot, knocked off number two Kentucky 77-71 to set up some interesting Final Four matchups. Any other thoughts on the Elite Eight?
Yeah, absolutely. That Virginia game required a last second field goal in regulation to make it to overtime, at which point Virginia decided to take control over Purdue. Carson Edwards, though, he had a ridiculous tournament, the guard for Purdue. He had 42 points in the game against Virginia, including 10 threes. He was a man on a mission. He said, all right, Purdue, I'm going to put you on my back and get us to the Final Four. Unfortunately, he ran into a very strong team in Virginia this year who is tied. They own the sole possession of the least losses right now in all of college basketball, with only three on the season, two of which came to Duke. So to make them go to overtime, really strong from Purdue. And yeah, the Auburn-Kentucky game, it had been all Kentucky all year against Auburn. They had played twice previously. There was a 2-point margin victory for Kentucky and about a 14 in the other game. But Auburn, they're on a roll. They won by six, and really the last minute of play, Kentucky, they were close, but they just couldn't get the bounces. And Auburn has been playing extraordinarily strong lately. So kudos to them for making as far as they did, being the lowest seed now in the Final Four.
Yeah, so the Final Four will be that number five Auburn team taking on number one Virginia. And then on the other side, we have number two Michigan State taking on number three Texas Tech. Should be a couple very interesting matchups there. We will talk about those more later on, unless you have anything else right now.
Yeah, I do have a few more things, actually, just about how good these teams have been recently. Auburn and Michigan State. My big gripe going into the March Madness was that they did not get rewarded based upon winning their conferences.
Oh, yes.
Auburn won the SEC tournament. Michigan State won the Big Ten tournament. I thought Michigan State deserved to be a number one, seeing how they won their tournament, as opposed to the ACC receiving three teams, with only obviously one of them winning the tournament, that being Duke. And Auburn was a five. Most certainly could have been a four or even a three. And Tennessee got a two. Well, Tennessee clearly did not deserve the two. They looked horrible in all their games. Auburn looked extremely strong. They are now 12-0 in their last 12 games, 14-1 over their last 15. Michigan State, 9-0 in their last 9, 14-1 over their last 15. And Virginia and Texas Tech have also been playing very well, 13-1 each over their last 14. So these teams have gotten on the roll at the right time. But Auburn, Michigan State did not receive the treatment from the committee that they did. Maybe the committee will finally say, maybe if these teams actually look good in the tournament, we should seed them higher. It makes sense to me, at least, for that to happen.
College sports are very strange in the way that they treat conferences, because they, in the regular season, they put a lot of emphasis into the conference schedule and how you do in your conference. But then it seems like come time for the postseason, that goes out the window, and they look at everything as a whole and bring in some other things. And it's just interesting the way that the focus can shift that way. As you pointed out, it probably should not, and these teams are proving that right now.
Yeah, Michigan State even had a three-game losing streak at one point in the season, which I'm sure most people wrote them off. I was one of them, because before that three-game losing streak, I said, oh, Michigan State, they're for real. Watch out for them. And then they must have heard me and got a three-game losing streak. I was like, oh, crap, that's it for Michigan State. Well, they turned on the right type of basketball at the right time, and clearly they've gotten to the promised land. While you need to look at the whole season to determine, you know, seeds appropriately, sometimes just don't look over too far. Just see, all right, in the other last 10, they're doing this well or they're doing that well. It's very interesting the way that seeds are ranked. But regardless, Final Four should be very exciting.
Should be very exciting, and we will cover how it wraps up next week. For now, we have some rule changes to address, starting in Major League Baseball. This was announced prior to the season starting, but we'll get to it now. A few changes this year and a few to come next year. My favorite one for this year, we have one trade deadline now in Major League Baseball.
Thank God.
Before, the July 31st deadline was a non-waiver trade deadline, and then there was another trade deadline, a waiver deadline, August 31st, and that drove me nuts. There should be one trade deadline, and that should be the end of it, and they have that, and I'm very excited that they have that.
Yeah, July 31st is the only trade deadline. No trades after July 31st. Get the players you want on your team by the end of July, because that's what your team's going to look like for the next 2 months moving forward. It was always so stupid to see, oh, he passed the waivers, and the trade went through. Well, why didn't someone claim him to say, no, don't make this trade? It was really annoying, because they were prolific trades, even. It's not like it was, you know, a backup third baseman for the third string right fielder or something. I mean, Andrew McCutchen was one last year that was after the July deadline, and he clearly is a very good player that should have been, if he was wanted to be traded before it, so glad to see that change. Another one to help speed the pace of play, each inning between the innings now will be 2 minutes on the dot. It previously was 2 minutes and 20 seconds for regional games, and I believe 2.5 minutes for nationally televised games. No more, just 2 minutes all across the board. Will this cut out an hour of the game time? Absolutely not. Will it cut out 4 minutes that nobody cares about? Absolutely. So good to see that happen. Also, two All-Star Game festivity-related ones. So there's the original All-Star Game voting that we all know and I guess love, that, you know, you vote in the players that you want. But now there's a, so to speak, election day where the top three vote-getters at each position will be voted upon in a battle for the starting position on the roster, which I guess is more fun. I mean, the All-Star Game is, it's whatever to me, but some people like that, and I guess it makes it more exciting. And the Home Run Derby also will receive a bigger cash prize, kind of to see more of the better players that deserve to be in the Home Run Derby joining. $1 million will go to the winner. $2.5 million total will go to all the players competing. So not individually, obviously, $2.5 million will be separated between them all, but, you know, it might be more exciting to see a Bryce Harper and a Mike Trout and a Cody Bellinger and Aaron Judge there as opposed to seeing Miguel Sano or what, something like that showing up, so should be exciting there.
Yeah, outside of the deadline change, it's really all about the entertainment. The vote allows the fans to get some more involvement, I guess, and see some extra things, better players in the Home Run Derby, the commercial breaks, fans don't have to wait as long. One other one, mound visit has been reduced. Last year, they were only allowed 6 per team per game. That has been dropped to 5. Any mound visit beyond the 5th, you have to remove the pitcher. So again, that's a stoppage in the game that they eliminate to speed things up, to keep fans engaged. For the most part, like I said, these all really revolve around the fans, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think these are all fine. There's nothing too earth-shattering. Just, it helps the game. I don't think any of them hurt the game. Now, when we look forward to 2020, there are some that certainly people will say this is hurting the game. It's a big one, too. I'm going to start with the pitchers. So there's a big thing that we saw in the playoffs last year, which drove me absolutely crazy, where you would throw a pitcher in and have him throw 4 pitches and say, all right, see you later. You've done your job. Well, now pitchers will be required to face at least 3 batters. Obviously, if they get injured, they will be taken out of the game. But they have to face at least 3 batters. I love it. I hate the way that pitchers are managed and the fact that you can just pick and pluck, oh, here's my lefty specialist. No, learn how to pitch against both people. Don't be specialists. Face the 3 batters that you need to face. I like this change a lot.
They are able to leave without facing 3 batters if they end the half inning. But it still eliminates the idea of coming in a, we'll say, bases loaded, no out situation, get one out and move on to the next guy. As far as I'm concerned, you can manage your team however you want. If that's how you feel like you want to use your pitchers, then so be it. For me personally, though, I like it because I can't stand seeing managers use their pitchers that way. Like I said, if that's what they want to do, that's what they want to do. They're getting paid more than I am. But for me personally, I don't like it. I just feel like you go through your bullpen too quickly, and I just don't enjoy watching it. Like you, I don't enjoy watching it. So that's a nice change. Also, position players will not be able to pitch anymore. Not that that happens very often.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
But it won't be happening unless they are in extra innings or the margin is 6 or more runs, which to me, a position player isn't pitching now unless that's what's happening. I don't know of any other reason that a position player would pitch, so I'm not sure that this rule is even all that necessary. There is a two-way designation, and that's based on innings pitched versus in at-bats, I think, for this season. So you can put players in a position to do both.
Basically the Ohtani rule.
Yeah, pretty much. Another one, no 40-man roster in 2020. The 25-man roster will increase to 26. You can add a 27th for doubleheaders. And for pitchers, minimum of 15 days on the injured list as opposed to a position player who can spend 10.
Yeah, I like that one a lot because, like I mentioned earlier, teams feel the freedom and liberty to put pitchers who may just be sore for 5 days on the injured list now for only 10 days. You maybe miss 1 to 2 starts and get a guy in AAA just to cover for you while you heal up and hang out in the dugout, which is annoying because clearly some of these guys, while they may still be injured or sore or whatever, they can pitch. And it makes the managers be more specific about, okay, I'm going to lose this guy for 3 starts now as opposed to just 2, so I have to be much more careful if I'm going to put him on that list. You said roster size going from 25 to 26. That kind of, I feel, goes in line with the fact that pitchers have to face at least three batters now, so they will be getting more tired. But at the same rate, you have another extra guy on your bench, which you can do 13 and 13, which I assume most managers would do. I would have, at least in that situation. You said 27 for doubleheaders. In September, you can actually go up to 28. So currently, you can include all 40 guys on your 40-man roster on the team. Most people don't do that. Most people, I'd say, add about 5-7 guys, somewhere around there, whether it's pinch hitters, pinch runners, random starters. But some teams, like last year, I'm sure Baltimore and Miami were essentially AAA teams that just had random people on their roster that nobody had heard of or cared about that would do absolutely nothing for their team. Now we are seeing, all right, you know, it's a little bit more serious. You know, if you want these extra players, make sure they're actually MLB roster ready. I like those a lot.
It's actually kind of interesting now that I'm looking at this a little bit more. The 19 rules kind of, like I said, are related to the fans, but the ones in 2020 seem to be designed to make the manager's life more difficult. Instead of having a pitcher come in for one batter, you're forced to make a more difficult decision in who you want to come in for a longer period of time. Can't just throw whoever you want to out there on the mound. Can't just bring up whoever you want to in September. I just think it's interesting, and you can't just throw pitchers on the IL for the heck of it. So kind of interesting the way that decisions will have to be made differently based on the rules that we'll see come into play in 2020.
Yeah, absolutely. Some more rule changes that happen, no longer in Major League Baseball. We are shifting gears to the National Football League. The biggest one we will get to last. I will start with some of the smaller ones right now. All blindside blocks, they're gone. No longer can blindside someone. That's an automatic penalty. On personal foul penalties on touchdowns, you can now, instead of having to take the 15 yards on the kickoff and kicking from the 50, you can take the, I assume, extra yard for the extra point and go for 2 points from the 1 yard line instead of the two. It's small, but it'll help them. Officials can disqualify people for flagrant football and non-football plays. Leaving things up to the discretion of NFL officials is never something that will work out well, so I don't know that I will like this rule very much. I don't know how much it will actually need to be enforced, though. I don't know what constitutes a flagrant football play, but we'll see. Matt, what is the big rule that we have been avoiding, though?
So the biggest rule that I am very happy to see change, pass interference is reviewable. It can be challenged. This is for 2019 only. It'll kind of go through a trial run, but you can now review pass interference calls and non-pass interference call, just like the Saints would have appreciated last postseason. But I think this is fantastic. 31 of the 32 NFL teams thought it was fantastic as well. Cincinnati Bengals were not on
board. What are you doing, Cincinnati?
For whatever reason. I think it's kind of funny. I don't really know why, but I think it's kind of funny. I don't know why you wouldn't want this to be passed. I think this is a terrific rule. People like to question instant replay and these types of rules because of the human component. They like the human component. The same thing with the automated strike zone that's been discussed in Major League Baseball. For me, though, I enjoy fairness. And if we can use technology to our advantage, technology that we are already using, and apply it to more places so that we get things right and the appropriate teams get the result that they're supposed to get, I'm in favor of it. And that I've talked about it on the show. The call in the Saints-Rams game drove me crazy because as the Saints, you work all season from August, before August, all the way to that point in January, and a wrong call made by an official cost you your season. That will not be the case anymore. I think it's great.
Yeah, even so, talking about the Saints, when they played against the Steelers, Joe Hayden had, he brushed his hand on the back of Alvin Kamara's jersey in the end zone on a fourth down play, was given pass interference. Well, it was absolutely not pass interference. Any review or official with a working set of eyes could have seen that. And then that swayed the whole situation of that game. The Saints ended up winning that game. But yeah, it's absolutely great. I think that while it will slow down a little bit, it's very important because there are certainly ticky-tack calls that will occur that, all right, maybe this wasn't such a pass interference. Or there's blatant ones like Nicole Roby Coleman just demolishing the Saints receiver and him looking at the ref and reacting because he wasn't thrown a flag. It's good. I do see this being a role moving forward, too. I don't think it would be limited to 2019.
I agree.
Will there be tweaks to it? I think there are. Already we see that you can't challenge within the last 2 minutes. It will have to be a booth review, similar to pretty much every other type of reviewable play in NFL that we see. But I think that this does nothing but aid and help NFL for the referees, certainly.
No, I definitely agree. And I've never understood why, if we have the technology to do instant replay and we use it in some situations, do we not make other things reviewable? And I understand that we don't want to challenge everything and review everything and have a football game take 5 hours. But I think if you can put a rule in place that can overturn 10 calls, 10 key calls throughout the season so that you get the appropriate result, I think it's well worth it.
Yeah, 100%. Now there is one last sport that we have not quite rule changes, but definitely structural changes to. It is the NASCAR Monster Energy Cup Series, and the schedule is getting a complete overhaul. The final race of the season will now occur at ISM Speedway, which is formerly known as Phoenix. This is the first time that Homestead of Miami has not hosted it since 2002, so racers had become accustomed to seeing Homestead Miami at the end of the schedule for the last 16 years, no longer next year. While Daytona has been heralded as the biggest and best in all of stock car racing to start the season, its secondary race, which had been held at July 4th since 1959, will now move to the end of the regular season, the end of August. The Brickyard 400, which is famous for the Indianapolis 500, that race will be moved to July 4th weekend. So we kind of see there's bigger races at bigger times. The Coca-Cola 600 now exists at Memorial Day weekend, kind of a big event there. And then we see the Brickyard move to July 4th weekend. So kind of, all right, here are the holidays. Here are the really big races we want on the schedule. Daytona starts and begins, or starts and ends the regular season, so good there, but definitely interesting to see the last race of the season finally change.
So you certainly know more about this topic than I do. However, I like the changes, and when we talked about it, when I read about it, the fact that the championship race had been held at the same place since 2002, I don't like that. I feel like, you know, these tracks are different, and drivers are going to like certain tracks more than others. And for me, when the last race of the season is at the same place every year, that's an advantage or a disadvantage to certain guys every year. I mean, I think it's the same thing with different fields in Major League Baseball. Some are for hitters, some are for pitchers. And if you settled at the same place every year, there's going to be a distinct advantage one way or another. So the fact that we're diversifying and we're going to see races at different places, I think makes it more fair to the racers. The Daytona track being used again at the end of the season as opposed to the 4th of July, I think because that track races differently than some other ones, it's going to make for an exciting finish to the regular season. I do kind of like the tradition of it being around the 4th of July every year, and it's been that way for so long. I'm a little bit disappointed to see that change, but from an entertainment perspective, you're going to see that last race be a little bit more unpredictable than maybe we've seen in recent years, and open up more possibilities for more drivers. So that can certainly be cause for an exciting end to the regular season.
Yeah, absolutely. Some other small ones occur throughout the season. Martinsville is known as the paperclip because the track looks like a paperclip, very short track. It recently got lights. Mother's Day weekend, it will have a race under the lights for the first time in the top circuit, which is very exciting. It will also be the penultimate race to end the season. It will be the last race of the third round of the playoffs. The Charlotte Road Course will be the last race of the second round, and Bristol, the other short track, will be the last race of the first round. So each end of the playoffs will see very unique tracks, hard to race at in some circumstances. It's not the standard mile and a half that the majority of the tracks are. Definitely interesting from there. Pocono, it's a track in Pennsylvania that it seems to rain at every single time there is a race there. Quite annoying. Well, we're crossing our fingers that the weekend of June 27th, 28th is a good one because there will be a doubleheader that weekend. Yes, Saturday and Sunday, there will be NASCAR races in the top circuit that count for both. So instead of having one race in June and one in August, both will happen that weekend. Just cross our fingers, doesn't rain. Wish me a happy birthday that weekend too, while you're at it, because my birthday is on the 27th. But still, certainly exciting changes there. Homestead of Miami no longer at the end of the season is now moved to the spring. Now you have to have a certain structure because you can clearly not have a race at Pennsylvania or Michigan in March while it is still freezing cold here and potential for snow. So those races, those tracks are clearly meant for the summer, but you can move a Miami around from fall to spring and there not be too much of an issue right there.
Yeah, certainly some things have to stay the way that they are, but I think it's exciting to see some changes. Obviously, it's been a long time since we've seen some changes, so interesting to see how that will play out this season. Now we move on to Quick Picks, where after 22 weeks of picking 7 games each week, Chris and I are dead even at 91-63. So these last few weeks here of our first season on the radio are big ones for our sake. Let's start this week in the National Hockey League. Some big matchups as we approach the playoffs. The Canadiens take on the Capitals this week. Big game here for the Canadiens as they try to get in, but I think the Capitals are going to take it. Both of these teams are playing extremely well, but I've said before, I don't think Montreal is going to get in. been. They've slipped out. I think that's where they're going to stay. I'm going to go with the Capitals.
Yeah, the Canadiens recently beat Tampa Bay 4-0, I believe, last night. I don't see them knocking off the other division leader in the East, that being Washington. I'm going to go with the Capitals in this one as well. Another big matchup with huge playoff implications is the Winnipeg Jets traveling to Denver to face the Colorado Avalanche. Winnipeg is still fighting for the first, second, or third seed in that division, is up in the air. Colorado essentially has the wild card wrapped up. For that reason, I think that Winnipeg is going to come out firing. I think they will be able to take this one against Colorado and help them secure the top seed in the Central.
I like the Avalanche. They are pretty much in, but they're not quite in. This is a big game that could get them in. 7-1-2 in their last 10. The Jets have been very average in their recent games. I'm going to take the Colorado Avalanche. Coyotes at Golden Knights. I'm going to take the Vegas Golden Knights. They are very strong at home. Darcy Kemper, questionable for the Coyotes. He took a stick to the eye last night.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so that's who the Coyotes have been riding on. He's played in 21 straight games. Oof. He may be in. He might not be. I'll take the
Golden
Knights.
With an eye patch on, maybe. But no, I'm going to go with the Coyotes in this one. The Knights have locked up the third seed in the Pacific. They literally just have to wait for the playoffs to start against the Sharks. So for that reason, I don't think they're going to be playing quite as hard as Arizona, who has to win their last two games. For that reason, I will go with the Coyotes. Moving into the NBA, we're going to go into the Western Conference, where things essentially are under wraps, except for the seeding can still switch around. Houston will be facing off against the Clippers in that game. I will go with Los Angeles. I just think that Houston, having already clinched their division, no longer has as much to play for as well, whereas the Clippers, it's still up in the air whether they may finish, so I will go with Los Angeles in this one.
I'm going to take the Rockets, because even though they have clinched their division, they're still jockeying for position just as much as anyone is. Both of these teams have won 8 of their last 10, playing very well, but the Clippers defense makes me nervous. 113.4 points per game they allow. James Harden's on the other side. I don't know that that's a good combination, so I'm going to take Houston. The Blazers at the Nuggets. These two are going to be playing a home and home coming up this week. Obviously, big implications there as well. I'm going to take a split. Both of these teams are very good at home. As we've talked about, the entire Western Conference is very good at home. Still jockeying for position. Division is up for grabs. I'm going to go with a split.
Denver got blown out of the water recently by Golden State. It was over a 20-point defeat. Really, really ugly game. For that reason, I think they're going to come out with vengeance. I think they're going to sweep this two-game set against the Blazers. They really need to wrap up this division. They have the potential to be the one. I don't know if that they can quite make it to the promised land, but if they can win these two, it can certainly put them on the right foot moving forward. For that reason, I will take the Nuggets in both. College basketball, Final Four, Michigan State and Texas Tech. I've talked about how I love the conference winners. For that reason, I will go with Michigan State. In my secondary bracket, I chose them to win it all. So naturally, I have to root for them in this game. I just think they have the stronger team. Texas Tech does not have quite the experience that Michigan State does. For that reason, I will choose Spartans.
I'm going to go with the Spartans as well. They're 11-3 against top 50 teams ranked in this tournament. I think I put a lot of stock in that. I think that they're going to do well. And it seems to be a redemption theme, so I'm going to go with them. And that's also why I'm going to take Virginia in their matchup against Auburn. Virginia was my winner, so I'm taking them either way. But again, it's the redemption. It's two teams that have struggled in recent tournaments, proven people wrong. Auburn's a hot team, but I've gone with Virginia since the start of the tournament. I got to do it again.
I will choose Auburn in this one. Once again, same reason Michigan State. Conference champions, respect them, please. They've been playing excellently of lately. Bruce Pearl has turned Auburn from a middle-of-the-pack SEC team to, obviously now, a national championship contender. For that reason, I will choose the Tigers. One last segment to get through really quickly. It's what to watch. I've heard people asking me all week, Chris, there's so many sports on this weekend. What should I focus on?
Nobody asked you that.
Well, I am here to let you know what to watch. It will start Thursday night. It's the NIT final. Yes, these teams did not make the college basketball March Madness tournament, but they got their own smaller tournament. It is Lipscomb. It is Texas. It is at 7 p.m. on ESPN. How these two teams got in the final. It's a whirlwind of excitement, I guarantee it. But NIT final, 7 p.m. ESPN Thursday night.
Two very interesting teams that have appeared to take two very different paths to this point. We'll see what happens. On the women's side of the bracket, the NCAA Women's Final Four is coming up this week. April 5th at 7, number one Baylor takes on number two Oregon. That is on ESPN at 7. At 9 o'clock, number one Notre Dame will take on number two UConn on ESPN2. So we've talked a lot about the men's side. The women's side also has some big games coming up. And then April 7th at 6 is the championship game. That will be on ESPN. As well.
Yeah, the UConn and Notre Dame rivalry, it's been happening in the past few years. Finally, UConn was not a one seed. it's not going to stop them from making their 12th straight Final Four, and they will be on display for
Incredible.
You on Friday night on ESPN2. Major League Baseball season just got underway, so of course there's going to be some exciting games to watch this weekend. We're going to start Sunday night. It's a West Coast rivalry. The Dodgers and the Rockies will be on 8:30 on ESPN. Will you see Clayton Kershaw? Absolutely not, but you will see a good Dodgers and a good Rockies team. On Monday night, if you don't like basketball, there is some baseball for you still on ESPN. It is a decimated Yankees roster versus the Astros, who should be doing better than they are. But 7 p.m. ESPN Monday, you can catch those two teams.
Couple of good games to watch early on in the season where it's anybody's game still. And just for Chris, April 7th, we do have a NASCAR race at Bristol Motor Speedway. It is on FS1. It's on at 2 o'clock. Tune in just for Chris's sake.
It is the Food City 500. It is exciting. Bristol is one of the best tracks. You can get around the whole track in about 16 seconds. It's a whirlwind of excitement for sure.
That is all the time that we have for tonight. Be sure to check us out on social media and tune in next week as we break down the NHL and the NBA playoffs. Until then, have a great night, everyone.